time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist on-air show is heard every Saturday morning, 7:30 a.m. in northeastern Ohio on WJCU 88.7 FM and streamed at WJCU.org. Our weekly podcast is available at the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com or download it with your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for July 25th, 2020. You know, it's not too often that we talk about mountain bikes, mountain biking, or even speak with a mountain bike legend. Today, though, we will be covering two of the three. Dave Weens is a six-time consecutive winner of the Leadville 100, besting both Lance Armstrong and Floyd Landis. Dave's a member of the Mountain Bike Hall of Fame. He developed the Mountain Sports Program at Western Colorado University and is one of the movers and shakers of the Gunnison Trails Network. If that isn't enough, he's also the executive director of IMBA, the International Mountain Biking Association. My conversation with him today covers all of this and more, as Dave Weens joins me for the full hour of the show. Hi, Dave. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week. I'm excited about you being my guest.
Thanks, Diane. I'm excited to be here.
Well, most of us are excited to be anywhere these days, I guess. So I should have had you on the show a long time ago. I've spoken to other people who are connected to IMBA, but, you know, the executive director is a pretty special person, and you're a pretty special person. I've really done a lot of deep diving and looking into who you are and where you have come from. But why don't you tell our listeners where you grew up and how you got into mountain biking?
Well, I grew up in a suburban Denver, lived in Arvada for a number of years. That's really those were my formidable years biking. And, you know, it's stamped in my mind. My dad taking my training wheels off of this hand-me-down bike that we had, a little Schwinn, kind of funny looking. It wasn't a Stingray. It had 20-inch wheels, if I remember right. And I'll just never forget heading down our street and just the wind in my hair. And you know, I was hooked at that point. I got sort of a Stingray-ish bike when I was six and eventually a Schwinn Varsity, which I rode all over the place. But, you know, and I built wooden jumps and did all that kind of thing too. But it wasn't bicycling so much for sport for me as a kid as it was the freedom, the independence, the range that it allowed for me to go places. And, you know, in Jefferson County Public Schools, you couldn't ride your bike to school until you were in the fourth grade. And I remember that was a big deal when I was in fourth grade, the first day of school, I rode my bike. And, you know, I rode my bike to school a lot, all through, you know, clear up until that magic day when you turn 16 and you get a driver's license. And then I know it was about the freedom and the independence and the range because I quit riding my bike at that
point. Right.
But not for very long because all of a sudden my range was drastically increased and I could do a whole bunch of things. But really at that time when I was sort of 14, 15, 16, I was way into river sports, rafting and whitewater kayaking and skiing. So the mountain bike definitely came on my radar around that time. I was working in a store, a specialty ski shop in Southeast Denver. And they also had backpacking. They had, you know, sneakers. They sold lacrosse equipment. They had a bike shop. And it was interesting. The owners of the store, they saw these mountain bikes and they said, you know, that's just a fad. We're not going to bring those in. So we just had oodles and oodles of what we called 10 speeds back in the day. But my buddy and I, we could order things. And so we found this bike out of Florida called a Trailmate because we couldn't afford to specialize. Those things were, I think, $800 or $900. But we could afford this Trailmate. It was a 5-speed with side pull brakes, beach cruiser, but it looked like a mountain bike. And I remember we got these bikes and he ordered one, I ordered one, and they were just a couple hundred dollars. And we took them to the Cherry Creek Reservoir Nature Trails, and we derbied them around on these trails. At that time, I'm sure now those trails are probably close to bikes as they should be because tons of people walking in there. But I remember coming out of there, and we just looked at each other, and we said, "Man, that was so much fun." And even with that bike, I did a bike packing trip in, I think, the summer of '82. I had these paperboy baskets from my Schwinn Varsity, big steel baskets that I used to use, not as a paper boy, but, you know, backpacks, they weren't as common back then. And I was, you know, I spent some time on the farm, so I always kind of considered my varsity to be more like a pickup truck. So I wanted sort of a bed to put things in. So that's where I got these steel baskets, and weight wasn't even on my radar because the Schwinn varsity already probably weighed 50 pounds and the baskets probably weighed another 10 or 15, but that didn't bother me. And I would put my books in there as I was riding to school. I was going to school out of district, so I didn't have transportation to this particular school other than a long bike ride. So I had those on this bike, and I went to Steamboat Springs. And I remember pushing this bike up a trail that was way too steep to ride up. And now I don't even think it's open to bikes. It was just a terrible trail. But at the top, it flattened out and it got really good. And I was going along, but all my weight, all my camping gear was in the back. So this bike was very back heavy. And if I hit a little rock or a root, my front end would just kind of float up in the air. I'm going to date myself. I'm going to say Chitty Chitty Bang Bang because the way that car, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I do.
And then I rode this amazing trail probably for 2.5 minutes, and then my entire rear derailleur just pretzeled, and the bike was done. It was not going to go anywhere again. And I camped out a night or two and hiked around and did that. And then when it came time to leave, I loaded the bike up, and I remember wearing my kayaking helmet with jeans and probably a flannel shirt and sneakers and side pull brakes. Remember, they don't really work.
Nope. Right.
And I would try to go down this trail, and I couldn't lower my seat. I didn't have a tool, so my seat was up really high. And I remember just flying down this trail out of control. And then there was a switchback, and I would just crash. And I just did that, you know, over and over. And there's people hiking up the trails looking at me like, my gosh, what is this? But so that was an early bikepacking experience. And then ironically, I just went bikepacking the other night, my second bikepacking trip ever with proper gear, and you know, just spent one night out, you know, just dipping my toe into that world. But I just thought that was interesting. So many decades apart, but really the same thing. You know, eventually I got a mountain bike and I started riding. And it was a great community here in Gunnison where I was going to school. A lot of my friends had started to race. I actually did my very first mountain bike races up in Alaska, of all places. They've had the Mountain Biking Association of Alaska. They've been racing up there, you know, for a long, long time. This was 1985 or 86. And, you know, they had the Iditarod bike way back when. So they've had a strong heritage of mountain biking up there, but did a couple races there and enjoyed it, you know, thought it was you know, really cool. And I can't say I was totally hooked, but a little bit. And then, you know, coming back here and jumping into the expert class in Colorado, we got to race against the pros right away. I mean, there was Ned Overend. There was, you know, Mike Closer, Rishi Graywall, some of the top people in the sport were, you know, in the starting field. So I got to measure myself against some of those guys right away. This is 1987, which was really cool. And then it was just a very fortunate time to be involved in the sport. I was very lucky, right place, right time, and was able to just, you know, sort of continue on and establish a career and a relationship with the bicycle industry. It started with Diamondback Bicycles and transitioned to Kona, and then as part of the Polo Ralph Lauren team. So I've been really lucky, you know, as far as being able to be involved in, you know, such an amazing sport from a relatively early time. I'm certainly not a pioneer. It belongs to a whole different group of folks, but I didn't come too far behind them, and obviously was able to ride on their, you know, all the things that they accomplished as far as the technology for our sport. You know, mountain bikes are just fantastic and amazing.
So let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Dave Weens. He is, well, he's a lot of things. Right now, he is the executive director of IMBA, the International Mountain Biking Association. But clearly, there is a long, stellar history behind that. I want to back up for two things. One is your Schwinn varsity. What color was it?
I don't remember exactly.
Was it blue or yellow?
Well, it was actually a sparkly red.
Oh.
And I know I've seen those blue ones and I've seen those yellow ones, but this one, I'm trying to think what model year it was. You know, my mom actually has that record. I could find out.
Of course she does.
A 70, let me think about this, 80, 64. It was a 74, 75,
wow,
somewhere right around there.
That's cool. The second thing I want to ask you is about falling down on mountain bikes, because it's the reason that it's always kept me away from mountain biking is I don't like to fall down. Well, now I'm too old to fall down. That's not a good idea. But it seems like mountain bikers think nothing about falling down, getting back up, and regardless of the shape they're in, getting back on a bike and just keep on going. Evidently, you have no fear of that, or do you?
No, certainly. No. I hate crashing. I don't like to crash. I try not to crash, and I don't crash very often. And you don't have to crash to ride a mountain bike. You know, there's a lot of imagery out there that if people see it, they're just like, oh, wow. You know, I had a woman tell me once, I'll give it a try, but man, I don't know what I'm going to do when I'm 6 feet up in the air like that. I was like, oh my gosh, you don't have to do that. So this is where high quality entry level trails come in. And you know, you can cut your teeth on a lot of different places. I mean, you can even use sidewalks as a start. Like our college campus up here in the summertime, there's no people up there. So sometimes we'll take, you know, ultra beginners up there just to get the fundamentals of braking and shifting and cornering down, because where it really gets tricky on the mountain bike is that the traction is much different and it can be a slipperier surface than on the road. But, you know, my point to people is you don't need to crash. Crashing is not necessarily a part of mountain biking. Certainly it can happen, but it doesn't need to be part of it. What I suggest is get good quality skills instruction if you want to learn how to ride a mountain bike. Now, if you're an athletic person and you just dive into things, sure, just you know, you're going to be fine. But if you're a little bit timid, find that quality ride instruction. There's a lot of opportunities out there. You can research on the internet. Those people will take you to the right trail. Your friends or your significant other oftentimes will take you to the wrong trail. They'll take you to a difficult trail because they want to show you how good they can ride.
Right.
And then you have a terrible experience and maybe you don't come back to the sport. So where you learn and who you learn from are very crucial. And, you know, no one just goes and rents, or very few people rent skis or a snowboard and goes up the lift to the top of a hill. You're not going to have a good experience. And mountain biking is much the same. Sure, riding a bike is relatively easy, but actually there's a whole bunch of people out there right now who didn't grow up riding bikes. Diane, you and I were given bikes by our parents and said, get out of here.
True.
Well, at some point along the way, I believe that stopped happening to the extent that it once did, because it became a safety issue and parents became more guarded of their children and it just didn't happen. I honestly believe if you were to look into this, you'd find a correlation between the declining sale of kids' bikes and the rising sale of the Razor scooter. And the Razor scooter became the bicycle. Every kid got one. And I think as a parent, you're like, oh, he or she isn't going to get very far on this. I don't have to worry about that. They're not for use out in the street and the roads. I mean, a bicycle, you see bicycles out on the street and the roads all the time. You don't see kids riding Razor scooters on the roads. So, man, we've got to get kids back on bikes. And, you know, mountain biking is really a fantastic on-ramp to do that, because it doesn't take place on the roads. There are no cars on the trails. There's tons of great youth programming now between NICA, which is high school mountain biking.
Right.
Many NICA leagues actually have middle school programs. There are a ton of Devo programs out there. There's the Little Bellas program. There's all kinds of fantastic programming opportunities to get kids on mountain bikes, riding on dirt in safe areas. And, you know, it's a challenge for IMBA to follow the programming with trails everywhere, because this programming is popping up in places like NICA teams are popping up in places around the country where there are no trails.
Huh.
And they're setting up cones on a ball field. Well, that's not going to keep kids engaged.
No.
Like a single track trail in the woods will. So we've got a tall challenge ahead of us to really make sure that everybody has a great place to ride close to where they live. And if we do want kids to ride bikes, and then that's where adult cyclists will eventually come from. We'll be able to repopulate the adult ranks, because a whole group of kids now grew up riding bikes again. That's where you and I came from, right?
Oh, sure.
And I think there's a bit of a gap now. And with this great youth programming that's happening over the last 10 or 15 years and so many kids riding, yeah, they might get their driver's license and fall away from it there for a few years. But all of a sudden, they're going to be 30. They're going to have families. They're going to have high-stress jobs. And they're going to be looking for something. They're going to go, oh, yeah, I can rip on a bike, on a mountain bike, because I did that when I was in middle school or high school. And then they're going to get into maybe road or gravel or commuting or more mountain biking or whatever it is. So lots of work to be done there to have, you know, trails all around the country close to communities matching up with the great programming that's available.
I am going to remind listeners again that we're speaking with Dave Weens, and we're talking about mountain biking. He's the executive director of IMBA, the International Mountain Biking Association. I want to back up a second because you're absolutely right about getting kids back on bikes and that mountain biking might be just the sort of vehicle, no pun intended, to get them there. So I wasn't going to get so heavily into IMBA, but since we're right there and I do want to talk about it, what exactly does IMBA do and how are you proposing to get trails in places where there are no trails right now? I mean, I can remember the struggle that we had with our Cleveland Metro Parks because it was a big fight between mountain biking and the equestrians who sort of supported the park system from the very beginning. And so mountain bikers were these upstarts, and what are you doing? And we're not giving up our bridle paths. Well, eventually, of course, they began to allow us on certain trails. We still don't have full access, but we do have a lot more than we did. So how do you do that in areas where you don't have beautiful metro parks or areas where they're setting up cones on ball fields, which just seems so strange?
Well, there's no doubt that it's a challenge, but really, IMBA, and this is way before my time, has done so much in the last 30 plus years for mountain biking and for access and for trails. And we can never forget our core work. And that core work is teaching and encouraging low impact riding, grassroots advocacy, sustainable trail design, innovative land management practices, cooperation among all trail user groups, as you mentioned, you know, with the equestrians, with walkers. IMBA also has a national network of local organizations. We're affiliated with individual riders, and there's, you know, oodles of passionate volunteers working together for the benefit of the entire community. A lot of times it's the mountain biking focused groups that are leading the trail maintenance work and things like that. But on top of that core work, it's really important that, and our focus is helping communities create more trails close to home. And our vision is that everyone has access to close to home rides as well as iconic backcountry experiences. And as you mentioned, it's a challenge. So one thing the pandemic has done is it's pushed a ton of people out onto trails, and communities were already really waking up to the idea of trails. And, you know, what's happened in Northwest Arkansas with the Walton family and their pursuit of trails to really create a quality of life amenity to not only attract, but also to retain a high quality workforce, also just happened to be a huge tourism draw. So what's happened in Northwest Arkansas has really gotten a lot of publicity all around the country and really globally. So now you're seeing communities going, oh, wait a minute. So the way we understand it, trails make communities and people happier, healthier, and more prosperous. Well, that's a pretty good thing. We should look into that. Additionally, a lot of parks and rec departments will put out these surveys. Okay, what park and rec amenities are you looking for? Trails almost always are at the very top of the list because they have such a broad appeal. And I'm not talking just, you know, mountain biking trails. We're talking big concrete trails all the way up to, you know, a double black diamond mountain bike trail and everything in between. They appeal to everybody way more so than a swimming pool or a fitness center or something like that. So there's data that suggests that trails are really important. And if it's an amenity that actually makes your community happier, healthier, more prosperous, that's fantastic. So before the pandemic, we were already seeing lots of communities going, okay, we're in. How do we make this happen? And that's the big challenge. And that's where it's something that at IMBA we call the ecosystem. And it's the process that a community needs to go through to get trails from the initial idea through first an assessment, because if you go to some places like Gunnison, we're surrounded by public lands. Your assessment is you guys have a lot of places you can build trails. You're talking about, you know, Cleveland or other places where the assessment is really critical and you need to come in and say, okay, that municipal golf course over there that's been shuttered for 3 years, that's a potential place that you could put trails. That area down by the river there's an area for trails. You've got a park that's open to, you know, so that's the assessment part. Then it's actually having the access, the permission to build, or develop or improve trails on any given piece of publicly accessible land. And, you know, that may take some collaboration with other user groups. trail runners, hikers, walkers, equestrians, in some cases, motorized users. So that access piece is really important, and that you get buy-in from the entire community is really a big deal, because that's when you're going to have success. If you know, one user group feels like they're being shut out of the process, it can create, you know, challenges down the road. So really, it's important that we get everybody together to collaborate. Funding is a big deal. You know, volunteers have built great trails for years and years and years, and that's going to continue to happen. But we're just simply not going to build the quality and the quantity of trails that are needed to really move the needle for people in places without professional contractors. And now we're talking about, you know, we're not talking about $30,000 or $50,000. We're talking about tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars that need to be invested in trail development all across the country and globally, for that matter. Europe has all kinds of fantastic trail opportunities and mountain bike specific opportunities as well. Same with Australia. South America is emerging. Mexico, there's, you know, the mountain bike is all around the world. People want these trails, but so is hiking, so is trail running. Human powered trail based recreation and fitness is exploding really all around the world. And mountain biking is a big part of that. And mountain biking has been the driver of innovation in trails. And, you know, we will continue to be that. And as a mountain biker, there's two really important factors to our experience. The first factor is the trail itself. And that's where mountain bike builders have, you know, they've built the most amazing trails. A walker, you don't get on a trail and go, oh, wow, man, this is a great trail. Trail runners kind of feel it, but they're not rolling. We're rolling across the earth, and we're rolling over things and around things. And we have the challenge of picking lines and things like that. So the trail itself is really important. The other really important element of not only a mountain biker's experience, but every trail user's experience is, what sort of encounters did you have when you were out on the trail? You could have a great day on your bike, but if you had an encounter that was negative with an equestrian or a hiker or another mountain biker, you come home feeling, you know, oh, you know, that wasn't the best possible experience. So our goal is really that whether you're a mountain biker, a walker, a trail runner, or an equestrian, you come back from your experience on the trails going, man, that was fantastic. And, you know, whatever we need to do to all work together to create first the ability for more people to have that experience, and then for it to actually come to fruition. And there's some challenging locations that you talked about one, large metro areas, lots of use. I mentioned earlier, COVID put just a ton of new people on the trails. It's new mountain bikers, it's new walkers, it's new trail runners, it's families. So we all of a sudden overnight, we got to see into the future, really. Here's what it would be like if a ton of people went out on the trails. And so that need for more and better trails and trail systems everywhere has really been brought front and center.
We're going to take a real short break, and we're going to come back and talk with Dave Wien some more. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Back on the show. I'm Diane Jenks, and you're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We're speaking with Dave Weens. He is a Mountain Bike Hall of Famer, but he is the Executive Director of IMBA, the International Mountain Biking Association. And I want to talk a little bit about the state of life today. So we were talking about how the trails are much more crowded, but my question is about who is on the trails and how we can make mountain biking and cycling in general a little more diverse. So maybe a lot more diverse. You know, when we look at the faces of the people on bikes, they look like us, you and me, white people. But there are lots of brown people who want to ride bicycles and may or may not feel welcome in our sport, number one. And I'm wondering what you see that mountain biking could give to the community to show a more inclusive way of being.
Yeah, that's a great observation that's very important right now. And I'm happy to report that thanks to our board of directors and a good portion of our staff, the diversity, equity, and inclusion work was already underway at IMBA. But with that being said, without a doubt, the recent events and the importance of the Black Lives Matter movement has accelerated our effort. And this work is front and center, top of the list. And among other things, here are a few specific examples of what IMBA is doing to address diversity, equity, and inclusion in mountain biking. First, we're working to increase the diversity of our own team, primarily by advancing how and where we post our employment opportunities. We need to make sure that we're getting a representative and diverse pool of applicants that we can choose from. Just as you mentioned, it's been a very white-dominated, the outdoor industry in general and the bike industry is really part of that. So it's not enough just to say that you want to hire diversity, but you have to make sure that you get those diverse applicants to choose from. Then, in our work to grow more trails close to home, we're focused on providing equity and access to trails for all people in all places. Everybody should have close access to great trails. A big part of this is working with local mountain biking and trail organizations. And we're doing this. We're sharing best practices. We're building tools and resources collaboratively around diversity, equity, and inclusion. There's a lot of learning that has to go on. And, you know, that's really a big part of it, too, is constant listening, constant learning. It runs through everything that we're doing so that we can become true allies. Also, evolving the imagery of mountain biking to portray diversity, equity, and inclusion is really important. So you're starting to see that throughout all platforms, but certainly in the outdoor world and in mountain biking specifically. So those are all some of the things we're doing. That's not an exhaustive list, but it is. It's front and center, and it's absolutely imperative that we make this progress.
So what do you say to people who say, well, I really can't afford a mountain bike, or I can't afford, I mean, it's an expensive sport. Are there ways you see of getting more, say, inner city kids on mountain bikes or camps for mountain biking, things that maybe would take kids on a trail that they didn't even realize was in their neighborhood or nearby?
Yeah, no, absolutely. That is a big question that comes up is, okay, it's easy to get people out, walking or running on trails, but the bicycle is a whole nother layer. And, thankfully there's already, and there has been for years, lots of organizations out there that do just that. They work to get underprivileged populations bicycles. The Trips for Kids program, I'm sure you've had Marilyn Price on your show. Chapters of Trips for Kids all around the country do a fantastic job of that. And I think we're going to see, a huge increase in the number of organizations doing that. There's a lot of ideas out there. Bicycle libraries where, you can check out a bike. And that's a big obstacle. But, with the number of old mountain bikes that are out there, but just as a good 26-inch wheel hardtail bike, there's tons of those out there. That's a great entry-level mountain bike to get, kids on, even adults. So you're absolutely right. The bicycle is it's a barrier for some socioeconomic background. It's a challenge, but there's organizations working on that. And, we certainly are, trying to help spread the word and encourage those kinds of organizations. It's not something that IMBA works directly on. We're more focused on, we'll help get the trails there. But it's a challenge for sure. But again, establishing that first experience. Just imagine these kids for the first time. And I felt it maybe I was 17 or 18, but just the turns of the trail and the wind in your hair and, the landscape, rushing by, it's powerful. And we need to make sure that we give that experience to more, because that experience right there will plant some seeds that become a crossroads and can take that individual off in some fantastic directions.
You also talked, and there was an article in Forbes yesterday, July 13th, I don't even know what day it is, maybe it was 2 days ago, that you were quoted as saying the pandemic has connected people with their trails in a dramatic fashion. And so when we think about crowding, that's one of the things we're not supposed to do, is get that close together. Has IMBA put up any kind of trail etiquette? And I know trail etiquette is a huge issue in terms of keeping trails clean, keeping the, you know, everything ecologically okay. But how about trail etiquette in times of COVID? Is there something that you're telling people they should or shouldn't do on the trail?
Yeah, absolutely. And really, it comes down to, you know, social distancing, wearing a mask, making decisions about, you know, whether or not you're going to continue on a trail where you see a ton of people. But if you go to EMBA.com or if you search EMBA and COVID-19, you'll come up with our page of recommendations. There's a whole bunch there. Most people, you can kind of figure out when your trails are the busiest. So try to go during the off hours. Parking lots can be crowded. Trails are almost like a supermarket where you have to funnel through the front doors. That's your trailhead. That's where there's going to be a lot of people around the kiosk and the restrooms and things like that. So if there's alternative accesses to your trail system, sort of a little side street, or, you know, a lot of times there's other ways to get into the system. When you plan your outing, you know, go early, go late, be ready to turn around and go back. And, you know, it's troublesome seeing the numbers increasing all around the country. So we're certainly not done with this yet, but, EMBA, if you Google EMBA and COVID-19, you'll come up with our page that has, a very long list of guidelines. Okay. I think that's probably the easiest thing to do.
That's good to know. So we've run into a situation here, and I'm not sure if you have in other places, where they have shut off the water and closed all the restrooms in all of our parks.
It's happening in places, you bet.
Yeah. So do you have recommendations as to approaching, say, the park services or whoever in terms of, well, you know, you can only carry so much water and we're going out for 80 miles or 70 miles or whatever it is. Turn the water back on. Open the restrooms up. What kinds of practices could you go to these officials with and say, look, we've got a solution? Do you have solutions? Do you have ideas?
No more than in a city park, for example. So I wish I could be helpful there.
Okay.
But it's not just at trailheads. I mean, you're seeing this happening in you know, parks and places everywhere. Some people are like, man, I'm thirsty. The water's turned off. I need to use the restroom. I need to wash my hands. And I'm not saying that we can't do anything about it, but it goes way beyond, you know, just the trailheads. And you're right. You know, planning for our rides and bringing extra water, or knowing, okay, there is a place I can actually stop and get some water. But it's made everybody plan a little bit differently. Have that little packet of wet wipes in your kit or your back pocket so you can your hands clean, have your mask, you know, on your person at all times, using the restrooms and having access to water certainly can be a challenge in some places.
Yeah.
But we all know that some municipalities are as simple as you go have a conversation with the city manager, the parks and rec director. It would be really hard to say, here's how we're going to make this safe. They're just looking at, hey, we're just going to shut it down. And that's one way to make it safe because no one's going to use it.
Right. Like you have no choice.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
We're not going to give you a choice. So I want to ask you to look in your crystal ball. Do you see, or what do you see for bicycling and mountain biking, say a year from now, when maybe we have a solution to what the problem is, 5 years net from now and going forward, how big will mountain biking continue to get? And will you still be able to attract all these new people to it? Because as the population ages, they kind of age out of mountain biking.
Yeah, there's no doubt that there is a certain demographic that's, you know, around our age, avid cyclists, and we are. We're getting older and aging out. It'll be really interesting to see how the younger generation comes back to the sport, because I do believe it's a great sport when you're a kid. It's a great sport as a late teenager and an early 20-year-old, but that's a very busy time in your life. It's also the time when you may not have the resources to own a mountain bike or even space to keep one. And so then I kind of think that it's going to be as it has been, where the interest will start to increase again when you're in your 30s and 40s and 50s, because exercise is only becoming more important to people. I mean, the evidence is there. The research is there. We need to exercise. So going to the gym can be pretty much drudgery. We can't play pickup basketball and, pick up softball and things like that until we're old. But this mountain biking and cycling, this is something that we can do until we're pretty old. And I do believe we're going to continue to see a lot of cyclists out there, you know, gravel biking, seeing some of the new directions that bicycling is going is really cool. The advancements in the technology on the mountain biking side are absolutely phenomenal. I mean, mountain bikes are incredible. I can't even imagine what the industry is going to have for us in 5 or 10 years, because the bikes are absolutely amazing right now. So, you know, I'm optimistic about what we're going to do. I think we're going to keep a large number of these riders, or a certain number of them anyway, who have come into our sport, because it's fun. It's just a fantastic sport. And if it's a turnkey experience, meaning if you have to load your car up and drive 45 minutes to an hour to get to your nearest trails, you're less likely to do it regularly. But if you can roll out of your driveway and you've got a safe route, and that's another thing that I think is really important, is this comprehensive community planning around walking and cycling, such that our communities become bikeable and walkable in all aspects. And that means that we're, as mountain bikers, hopefully, if you live in the right place, and hopefully there will be a lot more of the right places, you can ride to your ride in a safe manner. And when it becomes a turnkey experience like that, where it really only takes 45 minutes to an hour and a half, because you don't have a car ride in there, you don't have to load a bicycle, you just get dressed and roll out your front door, more and more people are going to do that. They're going to do it before work. They're going to do it at lunch. They're going to do it after work when the light is right. Mountain biking is, obviously, we understand that, you know, weekends and vacations for mountain biking, there's some phenomenal destination areas to go to. But what's really important to the mountain biker is that bread and butter, everyday experience, where we're probably imagining that we're riding in Crested Butte or Moab or Whistler, but we're just on our local trails, wherever they happen to be. And, you know, we're stretching our legs and we're breathing hard and we're doing the right thing for our bodies. We're clearing our minds. And, you know, if we can continue to create those, what we're calling more trails close to home everywhere, I think you're going to see a lot more mountain bikers. And, you know, again, any place that mountain bike trails have popped up, a lot of people start to ride in those communities. You'll see bike shops in communities that have a lot of trails. You'll see the mountain bikers there. And then if you go to a community that doesn't have trails, you may not see a bike shop there. You probably don't have a community of mountain bikers there. But as soon as that Nike team lands, or a club develops, or, you know, some seed is planted that starts to germinate, and trails are the key part of it. I mean, these fantastic machines, really, they're not much value without great trails to ride them on. So, you know, the machines the industry's producing and the trails go hand in hand, and they're, you know, one without the other doesn't really, you know, take advantage of all that it can be.
Well, right now, of course, we have sort of a dearth of equipment, but that'll change. That pipeline will get filled up again. We're going to take another short break, and we'll be back to talk with Dave some more. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We're back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm speaking with Dave Weens. He's the executive director of IMBA and so much more. I want to take a left turn, right turn, whatever, and talk a little bit more about you. You've done way more than IMBA. You are a ferocious competitor. You've won Leadville, 6 years in a row, which is just insane. You've beat Floyd Landis. You've beat Lance Armstrong. I love it. It's just awesome. And you beat him by a lot. One of the things you never did, though, and I heard this from Tyler Hamilton, is you never shaved your legs. Is that true?
Yeah. So, you know, as a mountain biker, and I was a mountain biker, you know, a lot of the mountain bikers that I first came into contact with, they'd come from road racing, they had a road racing background, and I just shunned that. And I've always, you know, whatever the quirk in my personality is, you know, I wanted to be a mountain biker to the core. And the other thing is, I'm not that hairy of a guy, and I'm blonde. So a lot of people see me, they're like, oh, you're shaving your legs. I'm like, nope, that's just the way they are. So it was, you know, it was my own sort of, you know, I wouldn't call it rebellion, but, you know, I was very, very much, I'm a mountain biker. I'm not a roadie. You know, there was that whole, and it's still probably out there a little bit, you know, roadie or mountain biker. And, you know, as a mountain biker, we were kind of the new kid on the block, and anything I could do to, you know, give a stiff arm to the road community, I would do at that time, you know, not understanding then that ultimately I would end up, you know, training for Leadville and training for bike racing later in my career, you know, using a road bike as a very important part of my training regimen. So anyway, that's the leg shaving story.
That's the leg shaving story. Okay. So tell us a little bit about Gunnison Trails and the original Growler. I want to get all these things in there, all these cool things you've done.
Oh yeah. So, you know, I've lived in Gunnison for 30 years, came to school up here at, you know, Western Colorado University in 1982, and at some point started riding and was really, you know, involved in the trail development around here at a place called Heartman Rocks for years and years. And we just got to a point where between, you know, a lot of rain, and it's a motorized area, so there's some motorized use out there, which is a little bit more impactful than just mountain bikes and walking. Some of our great trails were just falling to pieces, and it was a crime because people weren't riding them anymore. A trail called Josho's. We're not riding Josho's because there's a huge rut on it now. So 2006, I, you know, really started to work with the local land manager, the BLM, and started to earn their confidence, gain their confidence to let us go out and do trail maintenance. So we started to, for the first time, really do maintenance on these trails. At that same time, you know, eventually said, okay, let's just create an organization. We'll call it Gunnison Trails. Gunnison Trails is not a mountain biking organization. We, you know, our mission talks about self-powered trail use. So it's walking, it's trail running, and it's mountain biking. But certainly there's a lot of mountain bikers that are involved in it. And while I do those other activities, I'm primarily a mountain biker as well. But in addition to trail maintenance, we needed to educate trail users. Wildlife issues are a huge topic in a lot of places, particularly around here. But, you know, anywhere you're at, there could be any form of wildlife that needs protection seasonally or all the time or something. So that's one element of education, you know, riding responsibly, all of that kind of thing too. So maintain trails, educate trail users, and then look for opportunities for new trail development was also a big part of Gunnison Trails. So we worked for 11 years before we finally put a shovel in the ground in a different area close to Gunnison called the Signal Peak area. And now we've been building up there for a couple of years, and we've got a phenomenal system even closer than the Heartman Rock system. And really where I've been personally, but I mean, mountain bikers all over the world have been doing this, that, you know, there's very few mountain bikers who are interested in building trails out in the middle of nowhere. Building trails close to home. I mean, the more trails close to home that IMBA is focused on is what I've been doing around Gunnison for a long time. It's what the Crested Butte folks have been focused on up there. It's what people all around the country and the world have been doing, is they're building those trails that are close so that they can go ride them every single day. You know, it doesn't mean that we're not interested in backcountry riding too, and we certainly are. And I've been doing a good bit of that this summer. But it's those two things that go together. It's the more trails close to home combined with iconic backcountry experiences. And, you know, that really defines mountain biking for maybe not everybody, but for a lot of people. And so that's the work with Gunnison Trails, is it's really important to have that local trail organization. Two, you've got to maintain what you already have, you've got to do the educational pieces. And then if it's a priority or important in your area, you pursue, you know, trail development, either new or improved or whatever it may be. And so I'm proud to you know, started Gunnison Trails and had a lot of help along the way with great support and great work from, you know, board of directors and volunteers. I started the Growler, the original Growler in 2008 as a fundraising mechanism for Gunnison Trails. So that was a very popular race within a couple of years. And right now the Growler, and we couldn't have it this year, of course, because of COVID, but it's the lifeblood of Gunnison Trails. It provides the, you know, the funds that we need to have a full-time paid executive director, a gentleman named Tim Kugler, doing a fantastic job, took over for me. So anybody who's ever, you know, come to Gunnison and given us their entry fee and gone out and had a great day on the trails of Heartman Rocks and the original Growler, you know, your fingerprints are all over the trail maintenance. We were running like a 7 or 8 person youth crew this summer, paid, you know, $15 an hour. It's not great wages, but it's not bad. Paying kids to maintain and build trails. And we love that. That's a program that we got started 5 or 6 years ago. And then the new trail. So anyway, it's the Growler I created it, but I gave it to Gunnison Trails. Gunnison Trails owns and operates it. All the proceeds from that event benefit the organization. And, hopefully we'll be back in 2021. COVID free.
That would be nice from your mouth to whoever's ears. And then what about the mountain sports program at Western Colorado U?
Yeah. So, it was interesting. That's my school. I have great feelings for, Western State, as we used to call it when it was a college. But at some point I was approached by them and they said, hey, we've got this alum, a gentleman who's really interested in seeing if we can't kick Fort Lewis College's ass in cycling. So Fort Lewis College is in Durango, perennial competitor to Western in sports and whatnot. And they've got, pretty much the best cycling program in the country.
Hmm.
Perennial national champions in what they call the Omnium, which is they combine road, track,
right,
mountain, cyclocross. But their mountain bike team is just phenomenal. They have been upset a couple times. I think Brevard upset them 1 year and Colorado Mesa might have upset them 1 year. But this guy's like, how can we beat Fort Lewis? And they said, Dave, do some research, figure this out. And I looked into it and, the kind of town that Gunnison is and where we're located, we're in the high country, way, way higher than Durango. We have winter in spades here. It's a very hard, long winter. And we've just never been a real, racing-oriented community. We're more of a riding community. And Durango's has had this racing heritage, particularly in mountain biking, forever. And they just, they don't need to recruit. They might have a few riders on some small scholarships, but they just get good riders that go to Fort Lewis. And so if we were going to compete with them, and I was very clear about this, I said, we would essentially have to buy riders through scholarships, bring them here. And if we're going to do that, we're actually bringing, athletes here who may not really thrive in the winter here. How about if our goal is to, create a great program, let's think of it more as a mountain sports program. Let's bring in people who love to ride mountain bikes and want to race in the fall in the collegiate season, but then they're good with, they actually want to put their bike away and get their skis or their snowboard out. And they want to compete in big mountain, or they want to do ski racing, alpine ski racing, Nordic ski racing. We have one of the, maybe it's the only collegiate ski mountaineering team in the country, uphill, downhill ski racing, which is a fantastically niche sport. But Gunnison has always had this sort of, I don't want to call it multi-sport because it sounds like triathlon, but it's a lot of athletes here who transition with the season. So they're mountain bikers, they're climbers, they're paddlers, they're trail runners in the summer. And then in the winter, they put whatever that summer stuff is away and they get out the skis and they get out the snowboards and they do all different kinds of those activities. And it's just very seasonal. So that was really the impetus behind the mountain sports team is, let's create this authentic program with high quality coaching where if you are a mountain sports athlete and you want to compete in, an array of disciplines, you can go to westerncoloradouniversity.edu and then just, or do a Google search for Western Colorado University Mountain Sports and you'll get their webpage and you'll see all the offerings they've added. Rock climbing, the trail running team is fantastic. It's huge. And you can compete in these sports and you can compete from the highest level right down to sort of, just you don't want to take it as seriously, but you want to go out there and just, see what you can do. So it isn't an elite program only. That's what's so great about it. And we were very purposeful about that, making it so that it's very accepting, broad range, but really high quality coaching so that for those athletes who did want to excel, they'd have an opportunity to ride, ski, run, climb at the highest level possible. So that was really, me just putting some ideas together. And then I was part of getting the program off the ground. It certainly wasn't rocket science or anything. It's really a pretty natural extension of the athletic community that already exists here in the Gunnison Valley. And we just sort of, put a name to it. And it's over at Western. And I think it's doing really well. It's, it's bigger than the football team. And football is, it's a large program in a school. You can have probably close to 100 athletes on a football team, and I think mountain sports has 150.
It's interesting. People are going to listen to this and go, wow, I want to apply to that school. They may not know anything about it.
Yeah, no, if you love the outdoors, and Gunnison is a great town. Again, we have winter. Winter does come here. We won't even talk about fat biking. That was a sport that just took me last year, and it's one of the funnest things I've ever done.
Really?
Oh man, it is. So we won't even go there. But the ski and snowboarding up at Crested Butte Resort is as good as it gets. It's why I'm here. You know, when I came to Gunnison out of high school, I was a skier. And Crested Butte has, you know, some of the most fantastic terrain in Colorado, or even in the nation, but certainly in Colorado. And it's why I'm here. And, you know, I get a pass every winter. I don't get to ski as much as I used to, but I get to go up there. And the terrain that is up there, just it gets my heart pumping every single time. And so between that and the mountain biking and the fly fishing and the climbing and the running and the access to public lands, you know, it's a phenomenal place to go to school. The programs are fantastic. I mean, now you can get a master's up there in the outdoor industry, a business, a master's in an MBA in the outdoor industry.
Wow.
Which is a cool program. So there's a lot of things to look into at Western for sure.
Well, so you've answered a couple of my final questions. But I want to know what you do when you aren't thinking about working with or actually out mountain biking. And you can't say skiing. We already know you do that in the winter.
Yep. But Diane, I'm a very physical person. I mean, I do enjoy reading. I don't read as much as I should or I'd like to. You know, the news is really important. I love to know what's going on in the world, and The Economist magazine is something I love. But man, I mean, I could just sit there and read that thing all day. It's just endless. And, you know, I subscribe and those things started to stack up because
I know they do, don't they?
And I'm just like, man, I'm just not doing it. But, you know, Susan, my wife and I, we got a couple of our boys back for COVID. So, I mean, the glorious empty nest suddenly ended. But it was great. It was a great opportunity to spend some time with them again. Our oldest is down at Fort Lewis in Durango, and he's been good to go. We've been able to see him a couple times. But, you know, we're both physical people. We like to get out and stretch our legs. So we've been going on some trips, and it's low tech van life. We have an old 2001 Suburban. So really all it does is get us there, and we sleep in it, and we've got our bicycles, and we've got our running shoes, our hiking boots. And we've been exploring the state, but it really is. It's, you know, at 55, I'm listening to that Pink Floyd song Time, you know, you're running, run to catch up with the sun, but it's sinking, chasing around to come up behind you again. It's like, okay, I've got a lot less, you know, trail and mountain and that kind of stuff, you know, ahead of me than I have behind me. And so, you know, we're really getting out and enjoying the public lands and being outdoors and enjoying each other a lot, which is fantastic. And so, and short of that, being involved, you know, locally in the community with Gunnison Trails and things like that, I don't have much time to put in as I'd like to. I'm always saying, oh, you know, I'm going to get out and help with this or help with that. But really, you know, so many jobs are, you know, very, very busy. And IMBA is, you know, one of those jobs, like the jobs that so many of us have. And so that really keeps me hopping. And, you know, when we get that free time, particularly in the summer, you know, love to get out and do what we do. So, you know, that and spending time with my wife. And, you know, there's still some parenting that goes on. Try to be a little more hands off with that. But, you know, you don't just raise three boys and walk away when they turn 18.
No.
so that's been great. And then
there's still only 24 hours in the day. We haven't figured that out yet.
No, exactly. And we do try to get enough sleep, you know.
Yes.
Six to eight is luxurious. And I don't know what you're like, but I mean, we can't sleep eight if we try, you know. Sleeping in means you don't set the alarm and you still probably get up at five.
Right. Exactly.
That's just part of the age that we're in,
I guess.
But, you know, we certainly enjoy our lives and you know, stay plenty busy, even if it's just putting around the yard in the summertime and that kind of thing.
So I want to thank you, first of all, for taking time to talk with me today. It's been a delightful conversation. I have three questions that I ask my guests who spend this kind of time with me, and that is, what is your favorite food?
So Susan and I are both on the seafood diet. We seafood and we eat it. you know, we love Mexican food. We love, you know, we love the ethnic varieties. We're big on vegetables and salads. We do eat some meat, not tons of red meat. We like fish. We eat some chicken. I would have a hard pressed time to say I have a favorite food because okay. I mean, I like it all. I mean, of course, I love pizza and pasta and all that. So we eat it all. We eat the sweets and everything. So, but it's a, it's, I think it's a fairly healthy, well-rounded diet. So I would say we just like food.
Okay.
And we exercise to eat.
Right.
And I know that's common with a lot of the listeners out there.
That's true. So what kind of music do you like to listen to?
Oh, you know, I like so many different kinds. But on Pandora, there's something I have. It's called Dave Station. And the seeds are, you know, Tom Petty, Tool, Billie Eilish. I like some electronic music. I like some classical music.
Wow.
I like sort of the genre Americana, sometimes called alt country. Band called 16 Horsepower, some 70s hard rock, you know, the old Alice Cooper band and Black Sabbath.
Pretty eclectic.
So it's pretty eclectic. And so, you know, when you're sitting working at home all day, which so many of us do now, and I put Dave Station on it, what Pandora seems to do is it seems to grab each of those seeds and it gives you, you know, I don't know, 3 to 5 songs from each seed.
Right.
So you'll get on this sort of, you know, mix, and then it'll just transition to something completely different. But I like that. It keeps me going.
And the last question is about animals. Do you have any pets?
We don't. You know, Susan didn't grow up in a house with pets.
Hmm.
And we just decided early on, you know, as much as we, you know, love dogs, we're surrounded by dogs. All of our neighbors have dogs. Our friends have dogs. We do some dog sitting now and then. And the boys, you know, they certainly, you know, would have loved to have had a dog. But you know how it is. They're awesome. But it's another layer that you need to deal with, you know, if you're traveling a lot or things like that. So I did get a puppy, of course, as a freshman in college, like a lot of people do. And that dog, Josh, he lasted, I think, 13 years. And we had a lot of great adventures together. He's got a trail named for him out of Hartman Rocks, where he's buried. I mean, I talk to the neighbor's pets all the time. So I'm up and down the stairs to the office and up the garage. And, you know, there's the dog, there's the cats. You know, the cat lately has been finding bats and bringing bats home and eating in the backyard. So I call Waylon the bat cat.
Walking my dog yesterday, a cat was coming down a driveway and had the largest rodent in its mouth I had seen. And I'm like, I don't know where you found that. And it was clearly dead. And my dog was like, I don't know if I want the cat or I want the rat, you know? And she got neither. Well, Dave, thank you so much.
Diane, thank you. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate that.
It's my pleasure. We've been speaking with Dave Weens. If you want more information about IMBA, it is IMBA, IMBA.com, and everything's out there. And as we always say at the end of our show, go for a ride. Thank you so much, Dave, and have a great rest of your summer.
Thank you, Diane. You too.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
My sincere thanks to Dave for taking so much time to chat with me today. If you're interested in learning more about the work of the International Mountain Biking Association, you can log on to IMBA.com. Next week, we have Rolf Smith, an award-winning National Geographic journalist and photographer, and of course, he's also an avid cyclist. We also talk with some of the Sea Otter folks about Sea Otter Play, the virtual extravaganza that will take the place of the on-the-ground event this year. I hope you enjoyed the show. Please remember that you can always join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can send us a tweet at Outspoken Cyclist without the E. Or you can leave a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com, which many of you have been doing of late. Thank you. I hope you have a great week. Please stay safe, wear your mask, keep your distance, wash your hands, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.